You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hello, this is Stu. Before we get stuck into today's episode, just a reminder that my tour starts in the next few days with shows in Leicester, Maidenhead, Crawley, Hull, Liverpool, Manchester and Oxford. And that's just in February alone. So go to comedianscomedian.com/tour for all of your tickets if you live in any of those places. I would say particularly Hull, Liverpool and Manchester. I've got a lot more of a following in the south of the country than I do in the north. Although they're selling nicely, they're not really the kind of belly-busting ones that other shows have been. So if you live in Hull, Liverpool or Manchester, now is the time to get 10 friends together, drag them kicking and screaming to the show, and then sit there very smug afterwards as they tell you how much they loved it. So on with the show now.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. This is Stuart Goldsmith and today I'm talking to Tom Walker and Andrew Doyle. Tom is the creator of the ranting reporter caught on camera, Jonathan Pye. And Andrew Doyle, as you will hear, is, although not the creator of the character, is a co-writer for that character now that they have moved into performing live. So this is Tom and Andrew. So this is a completely unusual situation for me in that I rarely interview more than one person at once. And when I do, those people are invariably sketch groups or double acts. Mm-hmm. So talk to me about your relationship. Whilst introducing yourself to the listener, tell us what your roles are.
I'm Tom Walker, and I play and created and write for and sort of run the company that is Jonathan Pye.
And I am Andrew Doyle, and I am a stand-up comic, and I write with Tom.
And how long, given that you created Pye, mm-hmm. how long into the process did you start working with Andrew?
Well, Andrew really came on board when I was asked if I'd like to do a live show version of Jonathan Pye, to which my initial reaction was like, I don't know for a clue how that was going to work. Now, before that, you know, Andrew had seen some of the work and been relatively complimentary about some of it.
Not entirely.
So did you know each other? Did you ever
Andrew had written a play some years ago when I was a struggling actor. I was cast in it.
The lead part, actually.
It was the lead. Yeah. £100 a week or something.
Was it?
And, yeah, it was awful. And so we remained friends. And then when I was asked if I wanted to do a live show, I started chatting to Andrew about that. Andrew had written a few little bits for the show. I remember for the weekly thing that I do, I remember I was coming up to the new year and I wanted to do film three in a day, and I wanted to do a new year review, and I rang Andrew up and I went, Andrew, can you just do like a review of the year in sort of Jonathan Pye-esque language? And it came back and it was pretty decent. It was like, oh, I think you can probably write for this guy. And then when we started writing the show together,
yeah, so that when I first wrote for Tom, that was December 2015. So that would be
2-3 months into it, you know.
And then the life, it was actually quite fortuitous, because what happened was we were both in Australia at the same time in January of 2016, and Tom had been asked to do this live show. And I was in the back of nowhere. I was in, it's where they filmed Wolf Creek. So I was really in the outback, you know. And Tom had come and visit me in Sydney, where he was staying. So we went over there, and that's when we started talking about
We chatted about it the night before, and Andrew was like, well, how are you going to approach it? And I went, I've got no idea. I guess I'm going to stand in front of a telly for an hour and point at David Cameron and go, he's a dick, isn't he? You know, I didn't really know what to do. And Andrew started talking about, well, you need, before you write a joke, you need to get the structure right. There needs to be a beginning, middle and end. You need to think about this, this, this and this. And it was like, oh God. And then a few days, and then we were sat one day in a bar in Sydney, and it pissed down. It pissed down for hours and hours and hours, and we were really hungover. And Angie was just like, "Let's get this. Let's get. Shouldn't do that with the mics on. Let's get this structure sorted." So we started talking about why would Pi. So we started talking about, because I was worried about, I don't want to walk on stage and for Pi to suddenly become a self-aware satirist or a self-aware comedian. Yes. He doesn't know he's funny.
I think we should just briefly interrupt and explain who Pi is for people listening.
Oh, yes.
Who don't have the internet.
Yeah, so Jonathan Pi is a frustrated news reporter, really. That's sort of the subtitle. But it's... it was originally about the idea. There's a YouTube clip of Peter Sissons watching the Weakest Link slumped over the news desk because they've clearly gone to the weather. And he just looks at Anne Robinson and goes, Jesus Christ, she's even got new tits cut. And it's just this slice, this moment in time in the BBC studio. You can still watch it on YouTube. And I've watched that YouTube clip more than any other dogs dancing or whatever, you know. It's always stayed with me, that... So it was about that persona.
It's that
persona.
Moment when the camera is left on, either stopped. Before or yeah. after the recording.
Yeah.
So for people who are struggling to place, for example, your voice, you will know Jonathan Pye. He's that guy who
the
stands outside
reporter.
The Houses of Parliament tearing the
yeah.
earpiece out of his ear and going, oh, for Christ's sake, Tim, and, why can't we tell
and,
it by here?
Originally what it was about was this idea that we all have public, private, pub persona, work persona, that persona, blah, 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 and a news reporter... can extenuate that. He can exaggerate it because a news reporter's rhythm, the way he speaks, is very specific, it's very prescribed. So then when the news reporter then goes to the weather and then goes, oh, fuck me, oh, Jesus, oh, better out than in, that flip is so much more extreme. So that's why I hope people can relate to Jonathan Pye, the politics of it. It's political satire. It took me a long time to get round to the idea that I'm a political satirist rather than an actor or whatever. The politics was secondary, really, but I very quickly realised that a couple of videos I did went viral. I realised immediately, because I've been out of work for so long, that this was an opportunity, and an opportunity that I had to grab with both hands, because they don't come around very often. And I realised that the politics was what people were tuning in for, not necessarily the comedy. So it's been an odd balance to sort of try and get
that
right.
Yeah, because I think with a lot of things that go viral, there is an accidental quality.
Mm-hmm.
And something, we don't quite know why it is that this, mm-hmm. you know, cat jumping into a box is more successful than that cat jumping
yeah.
into
yeah,
a
yeah,
box,
yeah.
you know. And I suppose the challenge, now I've seen the live show, I saw the recording
oh, right, yes.
of the
right.
live show, which I thought was excellent.
Oh,
and
thank
I thought,
you.
You really have captured the way that you've really captured the spirit and the anger and the energy of the character in a way that clearly isn't just, you know, pointing at a screen
well,
and
yes.
going,
also,
look at this dick.
I mean, also the problem with that was, you know, how do you translate that conceit, what Tom was describing, of the off-camera moments to an hour-long show?
Yeah,
so we had,
how do
so,
you do something
so we
that's
had
like
to come
it's
up,
a three-minute form?
So we did
yeah.
this concept where he's host. I can say now,
because yeah,
he's hosting Children in Need night, and he's one of those, you know, when you cut away to someone who's in a provincial area, you know, and
yeah.
and they're obviously there all night with the crowd, and they only get the occasional minutes airtime. So that means we have him cutting away every now and then to the main studio, but for the rest of the time he just has to
and it's almost,
kill time.
It's almost like you're a TV warm up.
Yeah,
going,
and
right, well, we're all here. I might as well
yeah.
say something.
Yeah. And the problem with that for Pi was also he thought doing Children in Need would be a big step for him, so it's a big night for him, but also it's light entertainment. So he's totally out of his depth. He's replaced John Barrowman because John Barrowman's gone off sick. And it's that it was about that, right? What do these people do for that 30 minutes between? And to explain again that the character of to people that don't know him, I think every comedy character has a flaw. Essentially, you know, often it's snobbery, or often it's David Brent thinks being funny is more important, being popular is more important than being, you know. And with Pi, he's one of those people that can't not talk about politics. He can't not talk about it. But two, he can't not talk about it and get angry. And we all know those people in the pub that just, that's what they want to talk about. So that's his sort of flaw. So the problem is he's presenting Children in Need. And all he really wants to do is have a go at the Tories. And do you know what I mean? So I think we really nailed it with that sort of conceit for the first live show.
Yeah, and that all came from that. In fact, that all came from Australia when we were in that. Just
that,
it
that day, we suddenly came up with, he's presenting Red Nose Day, I think it might have been at the start. And then I rang Andrew a week or so later, I said, let's do this together. But by virtue of us doing it together, I mean, it was the most stressful 12 months of my life. I mean, without a shadow of a doubt. I've never wanted to be a stand-up comedian. That was never an ambition. And I suddenly found myself in Edinburgh at the Pleasance doing an hour-long stand-up show. As an actor, I'm used to rehearsal process and sitting down with people. It was very lonely. Obviously, I had Andrew, but it was a lonely thing to learn and get right. And I learned and got it right during a month whereby the press are allowed in. Do you know what I mean? I found Edinburgh an absolute abomination. I hated every fucking second of it.
And I will never. Listening to this.
I'll never go back. I'll never go back to that festival. I'll go back and watch it. I would never perform in it again. It made me ill.
It made you ill because of the pressure,
the stress of it.
You weren't doing it in a way like the way most people do it. You were doing it in a sense that you have a huge online audience.
Yeah.
Presumably, you put it on sale and it goes.
There was no flyering, was there?
I mean, this was the awful thing.
I didn't know you were there because I didn't see a flyer.
I think I gave out one flyer for all of Edinburgh. And there's going to be a lot of comedians listening to this go, he's moaning about Edinburgh. I mean, I cannot imagine what my Edinburgh would have been like had I had to go out and sell my own show. I'd have killed myself. I found it an oppressive, totally unartistic atmosphere, totally not freeing.
And it was tough, wasn't it? I mean,
and this awful thing of it was a palpable sense. I'm sure some of it is me being maybe over the top, but there was a sense that you'd walk into whatever bar it is full of comedians, and there was this look of this chancer, this wide boy coming in here, selling out the Pleasance, talking about, you know, and then ever since then, actually, it was post Edinburgh that we did this Trump video that went massively viral.
That's on like 3.5 million.
And the amount of comedians, nice. I mean, the
how
one
many is it?
150 million.
Oh, then I've seen a report. Yes, and someone's copied it, and that's got
three. The YouTube will be 3.5. It's Facebook that it's Facebook.
I've got 50 million on my platform. Viral Thread took it, and they got 120 million with it. I mean, it's crazy. But it was a contentious piece. It was a contentious piece, and it was saying things like, you bloody liberals, you need to stop calling people racist, because if you do that, if you don't engage with them, you get Brexit and Trump. And it pissed a lot of people off, but it pissed a lot of the comedy world up, because it wasn't the prescribed view from the comedy world. And the viciousness from these comedians.
That was really interesting, because maybe I should explain how that came about, actually, because it's quite... It was while we were on tour, wasn't it, with Trump, I think? We were staying in Bromsgrove in the Travelodge, and we decided to stay up and watch the election results and drink whiskey, and that's what we did. And we sort of wrote it during the night as the results were coming in, and...
I mean, the thing was, that night, I'm a geek for numbers. That's the only thing that I've been really politically engaged in all my life, is the American election. I'm looking at the numbers, and it's same with the British elections now, as they're coming in. I love all that. So I had some website up that could tell all the districts of everywhere and the blah, blah, blah.
And I
was really nerdy about blah, blah, blah. And I was looking at Florida that night, and really early in the evening, I went, I think he's going to take Florida, Andrew. And I was like, yeah, whatever. Blah, blah, blah. And I went, no. If he takes Florida, he wins the election. That I can't see a way through if he takes Florida. And then the TVs, the rhetoric started to change as the hours went on, from what do you think a Clinton administration would look like? Blah, blah, blah. And suddenly it started going, so if Trump were to win for the first time ever, and we went, he's going to do it. So we went, write it now.
Yeah. And then Ann Coulter was on TV gloating, and by that point the party's over, right? But yeah, we just wrote it there.
But we wrote, what do we want to say? And actually what we were both felt that night is how fucking awful did Hillary have to be to lose to this guy who's admitted to sexual assault. His rhetoric is I mean, it's borderline racist. Yeah. I mean, it's racist. A lot of it. It is now. I mean, it is now.
But he'd already said the thing about Mexicans being rapist, and that's
I'll give that. But, race definitely racist.
But interesting in terms of what you were saying about how you can't really anticipate the viral, how something goes viral. In the morning, I promise you, that morning, we were both hanging and we were talking about it, and we both agreed once this was posted, this of all the ones, this one wasn't going to go anywhere because we were convinced that because the audience are left-leaning, and this is so anti-left, in so far as it's blaming the left for Trump's rise, we both agreed, yeah, this is going to do no business. It's going to go nowhere. Mm. So you can't anticipate it. It was a complete...
Hang on.
Because I'm aware that because we just before we started, we went, right, we've only got an hour. I think I tend to talk quite quickly. I don't need to ask you, Tom, any questions about where the energy of pie comes from.
Right,
because you'll do it. And I think, Andrew, it's kind of, you've sped up how you talk in order to, you know, that's some of the fastest recording I've got on record.
Right. Okay.
Hands are
okay.
A bit shaking. So,
okay, let's just slow down.
There's so much to talk about here.
Yeah. Okay, okay.
I actually want to make sure that in at least one or two of these things, we get right to the gritty stuff.
Okay, yeah, you're good. You're like Markinson.
Some of the things I want to talk about are the reactions of other comics. We can come on to that.
Yep.
I want to talk about the way in which you seem to have stumbled, you as the creator of Pi, seem to have stumbled upon a thing without necessarily being that political a person. And like you say, I mean, in comedy we know, and I'm sure it's the same in acting, when your chance comes round, you've got to grab it with both hands, like you said. So with keeping that in mind... And I do want to talk as well about the writing relationship, how you affect each other and how much is written and then how much is improvised around what is written. There's loads. We could do the whole hour on just what we said so far.
Yeah.
So let's just start with the moment when you... Let's start with the very first video that you did.
Yeah.
And the success of that and what you felt as an actor... Like, were you chucking out lots of different types of character? Did this idea fall fully formed into your head on day one? Were you trying to make a thing go viral as an acting showreel? Who were you when you first created Pi?
The idea of Pi had been in my head for a few years, and actually 2 or 3 years before it all started, I'd gone out one Sunday with a few mates and filmed a few little things. What's really interesting, it is on YouTube to watch, it is officially the first video. What's interesting about that, there is no politics in it at all. There's not even a mention of politics. It's about the royal family. It's about he shits himself next to the cenotaph, and it's a really horrible moment for him because it's like, I think he said, you know, it's so disrespectful to the war dead because he literally just shat himself live on air. It was that sort of broad
and
humour.
The intention there was simply to do a funny
because it
character.
Was funny. I just thought it was funny. Never thought of myself as a character... as a character comedian, a character actor maybe, but this was a character I had. Then,
and when you say this is a character that you had you just done it off camera before?
It was just this idea of I reckon I can easily write some sketches if I can get a camera and editor and blah blah blah. And also it was to do with desperation. You go if I stick a camera pointing at Big Ben and stand in front of it with a microphone wearing a suit, I don't have to tell much of the story. It's so blatantly obvious.
And you don't have to spend much money on props.
Yeah, all of that.
What was the... You said there was a character you had done on that barge, which was similar
I had once attempted stand-up, and I'd done it as a character comedy, and I'd thought of this name, Jonathan Pi, and this was years ago.
The Battersea Bath.
The Battersea Bath.
Okay.
So that name had stuck. But then... I'd been an unemployed actor for basically 15 years, and during your 20s, I think you can... That's what they're there for, to fail, to succeed, and then fail, and to be poor, and have to scramble around for cash. And I was, you know... And then in your 30s, it gets harder, and it got to a point about 2.5 years ago where I didn't have any money. I didn't have any fucking money. I had no direction. I was depressed. And I realised that... With 40 coming over the hill, it's like this. I'm going to kill myself doing this acting thing. It's not worth it anymore.
I've sacrificed too much. A lot of friends. I did a year at drama school, having done some various other things, and so I'm kind of connected to a group of people who you see. People peel away.
Yeah.
People go, this is all well and good.
Yeah.
How much do you want it? And of course, at drama school, you want it like you burn like the sun.
Yeah.
And then eventually, you go, if it's just going to be call centres to make ends meet.
Yeah.
At what point do I still want it?
Yeah.
And at what point do I still want it?
And I thought I still wanted it, but I just thought I just can see that I'm in trouble here, really. So I did make a decision. I thought, I'll give it to the end of Christmas. And it was sort of that belligerent, I'll show you, I've failed. There was an element of that to it. But I thought, I'll give it till Christmas and I will call my agent New Year's Day and go, that's it. And then I'll do a teaching degree and then I'll kill myself. Brilliant. not necessarily in that order.
You've really got to spend the whole year of the teaching degree working out whether or not you really want to end
They're
2 years.
But I thought, the what was interesting is this is the point you were talking about. This sounds like the most pretentious thing I'll ever say. Stroke God. The cheesiest thing. But it's an Alanis Morissette lyric.
Oh, for fuck's
but it, every time I listen to this song, that lyric just goes dunk. And it's this really simple lyric. And she goes, the moment I let go of it is the moment I got more than I could handle. And psychologically, the minute I'd actually gone, I don't fucking care anymore. I'm done. And it wasn't angrily. It was just, but there, this weight sort of lifted. And then around this time, coincidentally, Jeremy Corbyn was running for Labour leader. And I was following him. I wasn't that engaged in politics, but I was following him again. He's interesting. He's interesting. He's populist in a popular lefty way. And he's a left winger. I like him. And one day I was watching him and he won the Labour leadership. And I just so happened to watch it on the TV. I was like, oh, fucking good for him. That's going to be interesting. And then they cut to outside and it was a reporter there. And the first thing she said to this other guy there, she said, how long do you think he's got? And I just looked at the telly and went, that's unbelievable. You have signed and sealed and delivered his execution 30 seconds. As a media, you've delivered his execution 30 seconds after he won the leadership. The BBC has decided that Jeremy Corbyn shouldn't be there. And my blood boiled. And I'm not a sort of person that really watches the telly and throws packets of crisps at question time.
Are you an angry person? Does your blood boil at other stuff, politics?
Yeah. Like someone getting in my way. Like today. On the way here, I couldn't find Andrew, and because London Bridge Station is in the middle of getting fucked up, and all these people saying, all these people, we're here to help. And I was going, look, and no one helped. And by the time Andrew called, I just, for fuck's sake, Andrew, I don't know if there's a fucking shithole in it. So that there are comparable moments. This was playing on my mind for days and days and days. I went round to someone's for dinner and I was discussing about it. And I said, I'd love to write something about it. The other thing is, I don't like to type too much on Facebook about I vote Labour. I find it a bit vulgar, wearing your politics on your sleeve via Facebook. But I thought this guy can do it for me. So, yeah, recorded this thing. It did got 1,000 views. And I thought that's amazing because that means people who I don't know have watched it. So I'll do one a week. Then the next week, about 3 days after that, Pig Gate broke. David Cameron fucking a pig. So it's like, well, I'll do politics this week. That one did better. And then the week after that, I thought, well, this politics thing is interesting. And I did one where I was on College Green and I had a go at fucking everyone. And then about 2 weeks after that, or it'd been out a good week or so, suddenly I got a phone call saying, your video's been viewed 1 million times. And then by the end of that weekend, it had been viewed 3 million times. And my life changed pretty much within 24 hours. I knew. This was it.
Had you already set up advertising income on that video in the background?
Oh, no. YouTube? And also it got stolen. And at the time, so I think on my Facebook feed, it's been viewed 100,000 times. Someone nicked it, stuck it on their thing and 3 million times, which at the time, I hated it. I'd kill for someone to do it again because as long as it goes viral, I've never met anyone that's made any money from YouTube, and I'm certainly not one of them. I mean, every now and then I get a cheque for 200 quid for 3 months of adverts. It's not a lucrative...
So when you say that your life changed in the sense you're not suddenly a YouTube millionaire overnight. What you are is someone who has a thing in which
I had... That Monday, I did an interview with the Daily Mirror, and then I was asked to go on television and talk about satire, talking about my work. Someone asked me to go on television and talk about my work. And I was just like, this is incredible. So it was like, how do we keep this going?
Can I ask how that felt to be asked to talk about your work? Were you nervous? Did you feel you make an arsehole of yourself? Or did you feel confident?
I was really, no. I was really nervous. But you just go... and also my overarching view at the end of that weekend was, I think I've got a fortnight. I think I've got about a fortnight here to, and then it will just die down. So let's see if I can, in my acting career, if I could just take a little step up. You go, maybe this might reinvigorate something.
And at the time, you're thinking, actually, what this is, it's an acting course.
It was an acting job.
That's the, yeah, it's an all acting
it was.
Job.
Because... It was an acting job that I had to write each week.
So these are the people behind Jonathan Pye, Tom Walker and Andrew Doyle. And I think this makes for a really interesting conversation. Before we get back to it, a couple of things. I am on tour, as you know, as I said at the beginning of this episode. You can go to comedianscomedian.com/tour for all your information on the forthcoming shows. I suppose I'll tell you briefly which some of them are. By the time you hear this, maybe I will already have been to Leicester, but Maidenhead is not far behind. Then I'm in Crawley, Hull, Liverpool, Manchester, Oxford, Dublin, Nottingham, Reading, Corsham, Bristol, Bath, Norwich, Northampton, Warwick Arts Centre, Shrewsbury, Swindon, Farnham, Aldershot, Sheffield, York, Newcastle, Leeds, Southampton, Cambridge, Edinburgh, Glasgow, Birmingham, Brighton, London, Tring and Cardiff. I'm also at the Secret Mystery Festival in Wales, which many of you know about now and is not all that secret anymore. So if you'd like to go to comedianscomedian.com/tour, then you can come and see me live and bring several friends, particularly if you live in the Liverpool or Manchester areas, or indeed Hull, where let's politely say I'm still cultivating a live fan base. But I've had some lovely shows there before, so I hope you will come along. You can support this show as ever at /donate, comedianscomedian.com/donate. You are signing up in your dribs for donations, either one-off or subscription-based. And actually, I'm just very quickly going to tell you the names of some lovely people who have been donating recently. Sarah, thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Emma. Thank you, James. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, who's that? That's Christopher. And thank you, who's the other one who I haven't replied to yet? Dave. Thanks, all of you, for your donations in the various forms in which they came. So, two emails, and then we'll get back to Mr. Messrs. Walker and Doyle and Pye. Mark says, "Hey, Stuart, I live in Boise, Idaho." God, love that. But I'm originally from Hull. That's Kingston-upon, by the way. Yes, yes, I know. I'm terribly sorry to have forgotten the phrase, the name, Kingston-upon Hull. Maybe that's why the ticket sales for Hull are so... What's a polite way of saying I haven't sold much in Hull? Nonetheless, I have accidentally slammed the town of Kingston-upon-Hull, and I did not mean to, so I hope they can forgive me. Looking very much forward to playing the venue Fruit there. Had a lovely show there last year. Now, I'm originally from Hull, but Kingston-upon. I was one of the lucky ones to get your Compared to What album. I loved it, he says. I played it on a 9-hour road trip to Vegas, and all the Yanks love it, even the trumpeteers. I believe I may have inadvertently become your US ambassador. Thanks so much. I hope it wasn't back-to-back 9 times on a 9-hour road trip to Vegas. Although I'm sure at least one of you has done that. I have been listening to the podcast religiously, he goes on, but had never ventured further than my podcast app other than to sign up to the newsletter. So when I heard your work, I was shocked at how amazing you are. Loved it. Mark, thank you so much. I will forgive you the slight sting that comes with you being shocked, but thanks. Thanks so much. Listen, everybody... all of you, hi, get in touch on the Facebook group. You can join the Facebook podcast community, the Comedians Comedian Facebook group. You can search for that and join. It's nearly 6,000 people in there, and it's a very fun and engaging place to go with lots of people giving opinions and suggestions and offering spare tickets for comedy gigs and stuff like that. Get in touch with me on there or on Twitter at ComComPod or info@comedianscomedian.com. And just let me know if you're so inclined. If you're someone who paid for the album Compared to What, you remember I gave away 1,000 of them and then I set the rest of it. I whipped them off the feed and then set it to sell. It's so nice to give it away and you get responses like Mark. And that's an important aspect of, because I'm, you know, this podcast isn't me doing stand up. And ultimately part of my job is to make you, the listener, know that I'm actually fucking good at comedy and to make you, to invite you warmly and inspire you to come and see me live. I don't, you know, a lot of comedy podcasts, the person is being funny the whole time. So you go, ah, he's a funny guy, I'll go and see him. This is obviously a slightly different fit to that. It would sort of make sense for me to just give away my albums every year, wouldn't it? or if not every year, at least this one, it's so nice when people get in touch and say, oh, I love the podcast, but then I heard your album and it's converted me and I'm now a fan of your comedy. My question is this. Would you, the listener who paid for the album, be really angry if, having paid for it, I then gave it away to people? I'm sure you wouldn't. You're lovely. Let's find out. I will ask in the podcast group. Thank you, Mark. Thanks for the email. Really appreciate it. And one last email from Emma, just a quickie. Emma says, Stuart, I wanted to say a massive thank you. I was too nervous to say too much when you performed at Northampton, but you saved me whilst I was at university. Thanks again, Emma. Emma, the podcast didn't save you. You saved yourself. You just happened to be listening to the podcast whilst you were doing it. And I wish that was an original thought, but I've stolen it from John Darnell of the Mountain Goats, who replied like that when I saw them at a gig and someone shouted, you saved my life. So I've stolen that sentiment, but I absolutely mean it. And thank you, Emma, for giving me the opportunity to say that. You saved yourself, and congratulations for saving yourself. Please come and say hello next time. That'll do. Got some belters in the can coming up soon, but I'll tell you a bit more about them at the end. Get on those tour tickets coming up over the next month or two. Remember, it's Leicester, Maidenhead, Crawley, Hull, Liverpool, Manchester, and then Oxford, Dublin, Nottingham, Reading, Corsham, Mac, Bristol, Bath, Norwich, Northampton, and so on and so on and so on. 40 dates. I'll be badgering you as we go, but I do hope you'll come along to one of them. Comedianscomedian.com/tour, and you can join the people of Boise, Idaho, in discovering how, quote, amazing I am. And being, quote, shocked at that discovery. So that's all of that. I'm going to talk to you a little bit more at the end of this episode about why this is a slightly different form to the initial edition of this episode, in case that's confusing you. But if that sentence itself confuses you, I shouldn't worry about it. I'll chat to you after we return to Tom Walker and Andrew Doyle.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
At what point did you, Andrew, become aware of Jonathan Pye's success? Were you talking about it before it kind of exploded?
We spoke on the phone.
We spoke a couple of weeks after, actually, because we weren't that in contact. And it was.
Because we'd
met, what, 12, 13 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Stayed in contact. That year, we'd gone out a couple of times. So we were sort of sporadically in contact. At the time that video happened, we hadn't spoken for a couple of months, I don't think. We did speak after that one went viral, though. I remember it was like the day or two after. And I was, you know, and you were telling me about it. And that's when I was aware of it. But I wasn't aware of it really before because we hadn't spoken. So Tom hadn't told me he was doing this.
And when your mate told you that his video had gone massively viral, you, a circuit comedian in the UK, teacher of comedy. I don't know about your other kind of, you a comedy writer in your own...
I write plays and musicals.
Okay, gotcha. I had you pegged as kind of a writer, but I didn't know if you were like a writer for Mock the Week writer.
No.
Okay.
So I
know you as a very strong stand-up with a really sort of acidic voice.
Yeah, so I balance the stand-up with the writing. Gotcha. That's what I do.
So did part of you go, were you jealous that your friend, I'm just trying to put myself in the shoes of someone going, hey, mate, I'm massively viral in an industry I don't care about.
No, because at that...
Could I just interrupt you there? I didn't, for many, many months, consider that what had happened made me part of the comedy industry. So I didn't consider it a
I wasn't a comedian, but Andrew is a comedian.
But it didn't seem like comedy until I'm so sorry to interrupt. But I don't think it became a comparable success to what you might have had ambitions towards until the live show was mooted. I don't think you'd have seen.
I didn't see it as comparable. I really didn't. But not only that, had it been comparable, I think it's fair to say, you know, we've been very close for a long time, and I do consider myself on the same side of the seesaw as you. You know, if something good happens to Tom, I feel good as well. If something bad happens to Tom, I feel good. Whereas I will admit that with some friends, I'm on the other side of the seesaw, so when they feel something bad happens to them, I get a bit of schadenfreude and I go up, and vice versa. So I would, but with Tom, because we've been so close, I genuinely didn't feel jealousy. But I think maybe that's partly because of what Tom says, because it wasn't the same as what I was doing. So I remember
when I said, because also it's like Phil McIntyre's asked me if I'd like to do a live show, you know, and Andrew's been plugging away for 10, 15 years at stand-up. I do wonder if at that point it's like, because that's the feeling I get generally, is like, I haven't earned my stripes. Is that, that's the sense I get from comedians. Yeah, I don't know whether you thought...
Yes, but bear in mind that I've known you for a long time, so I've known how much of a slog it's been for you in terms of your career. So I don't think I felt that. But we talked about the video, and I think we talked about, and then we spoke a few weeks after that when you'd done a few more, I think.
Yeah.
And we talked about, you've mentioned this before, so I think I'm okay to mention this.
Yeah.
I did say I felt it was a bit too following the Guardian line and sort of a politically a bit predictable in that sense.
Andrew's much more of a political animal than me. Okay. And Andrew, when he said, well, it's very much the Guardian view, it was sort of like, well, what's wrong with that?
Obviously, that's the right view, right?
I mean, what Andrew has really brought to the table is, especially during Brexit, is a different point of view. And Jonathan Pye is so much more richer now that he isn't just an anti-Tory mouthpiece. Many of my fans would disagree, because most liberal lefties hate being disagreed with. But the fact that Pye is balanced about Brexit, he genuinely understands why both people voted the way they did, that's Andrew's influence. Otherwise he'd have been a Remainer through and through. It's much more interesting that he's a reluctant Remainer and that hates Remainers that assume everyone that voted Leave is a bigot. That's his Brexit outlook.
So given that, what I'm really fascinated by is that you are, like, you know, you're, we can now talk about your work, your work as satirists, because now there is a huge body of work. There's 2.5 years worth of weekly videos out there, some of them enormously viral. Mm-hmm. Even your smallest one, I'm sure, has got 50,000 hits or something like that.
Yeah.
But in terms of your work as satirists, it seems to me to be very unusual to have such kind of unfettered access, such kind of shareability with the man in the street, the person in the mm-hmm. street. And for that not to be linked to the performer, you, Tom, for that not to be linked to your burning political beliefs. And I'm interested in, I mean, it is linked to your beliefs, but I suppose what I mean is, if we think of another satirist, who I can't off the top of my head, who's mm-hmm. who's a popular satirist?
Well, Iannucci or Chris Morris? Or...
Sure. So someone like that, like, their beliefs are kind of the foundation of it, whereas I'm interested in the richness that you say that it gives. I'm not trying to catch you out.
No,
challenge you on it. But I'm really fascinated that someone who, certainly I've had Jonathan Pye videos shared with me, like, we've got to talk about this, we've got to think, this guy gets it.
Yeah.
And actually, the guy getting it is a combination of different opinions. Not right and left.
But isn't that every sort of comparable piece of work or piece of art, that there are pulleys and levers and strings, you know, like, so any stand-up comedian, so I'd actually, you know, if you say some angry satirist, I mean, Frankie Boyle gets up there and blah blah blah, the fact that, you know, if you do it well, you can't see the levers and you can't see the strings, but actually the fact that he might care about Brexit policy more than I do, but I'm more worried about where's the character this week or whatever, blah blah blah. Pye looks like I'm making it up as I go along, whereas actually every week it's every and ah is is slowly painted on to this script every week. But when you see it, it's like some guy just fucking swearing about the fucking Tories. But you go, no, it's taken delicacy. So just because the political passion isn't there, I think sometimes that me being able to look at it from a little bit of distance gives it a lightness of touch sometimes and makes me go, fuck it, let's have a look from the other side.
Well, look, also, we've had a lot of conversations, and sometimes it gets to the point where it will be like, well, Pi wouldn't think that.
Yeah, all the time.
If I write a line and I think, oh, that's good, and then Tom might say, no, but Pi wouldn't think that, and I'm like, no, Pi wouldn't think that. And then it's not, because it's not just a mouthpiece for what we think. And we're not
but
entirely...
Also it's a satire, not... The character isn't all the satire. You know, it really, really annoys me, and I've done it many, many times, where Pi will make a point about women's rights or gay rights... And right at the end, I will deliberately put a joke in at the end which undermines everything he's just said for 3 minutes. Because it's stylistically fun, it makes you think, blah, blah, blah. And the amount of people that come back and go, well, he's a misogynist. You go, no, he's a fictional character whereby I've just written a structured piece, you know. That takes... it's not all about the character. The satire itself, he's a satire on the left in itself. Do you know what I mean? So we're bound not to agree with everything that he says.
Yeah.
You know.
I think we're broadly aligned with each other on political issues, aren't we?
Yeah, I think so. I think you're a bit more stalwart about certain things. I think I'm a little bit more pragmatic about things. So, like when it comes to Brexit, I think...
Yeah.
Can you give us an example of something that you would slightly differ on, something you're more pragmatic about? Like with regard to Brexit, like specifically what? Are there moments when that feeds into the conversation about what Pi would or wouldn't say?
It's about what people are sort of passionate about, you know,
yeah.
I suppose.
Can you tie it down to a specific conversation you've had with each other?
Can you, Tom?
You're allowed to take your time and I'll cut out the pauses.
Oh, really? Let me think. I suppose Brexit is the most obvious example, or...
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of... Andrew's taught me... Andrew's much more of a Eurosceptic than I am. I don't particularly like it. He's taught me why the EU is so awful. But I sort of think, pragmatically, we were probably better to stay where we were, you know, so I think, on a pragmatic level. You know.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's a good example. So I voted Leave on the principle that I don't believe... I couldn't reconcile the idea of being on the left with voting for a big right-wing corporate bloc. I don't think that works. So that's why, but that was entirely on principle. If someone had said to me, we're going to be a lot worse off as a result, that wouldn't even factor in what I'm thinking.
Whereas I would be pragmatic and you go, I might agree with you on that. But actually the reality is if more people are going to suffer because of it, you need to sort of forget your principles. So we've had some arguments about that.
Yeah.
That you go, well, yeah, but on principle you can't. And you go, yeah, but. On principle, you kind of have to sometimes. You know,
so that I suppose is the best example.
And also Obama. I was a big fan of him. I thought he genuinely was a great president. And you were like, you're a bit meh. Well,
no, I just thought he was a bit hawkish. And I think,
I thought he was. It's just the president. He's the commander in chief of the biggest army on the planet. Of course, he's going to have to blow some people up sometimes.
We're not going to have a row now. If that's what you're trying to get out of us,
absolutely not. But I do think it's fascinating that if you are a Leave voter and you're a Remain voter, which I think you've implied, mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
That, like, that to me is absolutely fascinating. That the engine driving this very rich character,
yeah.
who is one of the most prominent political mouthpieces, certainly in terms of Facebook videos,
yeah.
which is where that character is driven by a writing double act. Who voted in opposing directions?
Yes,
like, isn't that fascinating?
But that within itself proves Remainers wrong. That Andrew is a bigot. That Andrew is stupid. That Andrew is misinformed. That Andrew is somehow a racist. That, do you know what I mean? By virtue of that, what we've managed to do is, I think Pi is the only one that is going, I think it's shitty that we're leaving. But you fucking Remainers need to wind your neck in when you're accusing people of being stupid, and in exactly the same way that they did with Trump. The idea that everyone voted for Trump is a misogynist or is a racist, yeah, is demonstrably not true.
We choose the outliers, don't we? We see one person in a Trump hat punch someone at a demo, and we go, well, they're all like that.
And also,
and they see one of us if they are something, you know, the extreme edge of trans rights, and they go, well, they're all like that.
Yeah,
it's this thing about the polarisation of politics. It's this oversimplification, because it's easier for us to understand politics if we oversimplify it, if we adhere to an ideology where we're not looking at the nuance. You know, it's very easy to say not only all Trump voters are misogynists, even the many millions of females, they're just suffering from internalized misogyny, then that's the explanation, and then we don't have to think about it. And that's a real problem, I think, particularly on the left, or what the people who think they're on the left.
So is what's most important to you, both or individually, per video? Is it the political message, or is it the jokes?
I've done one this week, which is he's singing and dancing because he's about to go off for Christmas, and he shouts at Laura Koonsberg from across the way, and it's one of my favourite ones we've done in a long time.
It's really funny
because it's funny,
yeah, it's silly,
and it does have something to say. There is something to say about Brexit, and it's like this week it's Leavers, if you think that the end of Brexit has just suddenly happened, you're wrong. Remainers, if you think you've suddenly stopped Brexit, you're wrong. But merry fucking Christmas, and it's funny, and those are the ones that I really like. And then there's some that I'm really proud of. That I did one about homelessness last year, and I just think I nailed it last year, and I'm really proud of that, and I'm really proud of some of them. But I find the weekly ones, it's a slog now.
I love the ones which have a silliness element. Yeah. I really, really like the one where you're talking to the 5-year-old boy.
I love that
because it's just a really lovely conceit. But on the other hand, I'm also fond of... I do really like the viral Trump one, because I think it was...
There's one where I'm in Salford, because Salford's got a swearing ban in it, and it's around Media City. There's the BBC, there's the ITV. It's supposed to be the liberal elite kind of mecca, but you're not allowed to swear on the street. So he's just there going, bollocks! And it's so pie to be, you know... And I mean, that's another thing that I think pie is a huge... It's not just anti-Tory, it's not just anti-Trump, it's not just sort of a reasonable discussion about Brexit, but it's freedom of speech. You know, this, it's totally fucked at the minute. Yeah. And you know, he's a big stalwart for that. He's a proper liberal, you know.
We were actually breaking the law by making that video. Because we were standing on Salford Quays, he's shouting tits. Whenever I'm filming, I'm always slightly on the lookout that someone's going to come over, because they did in Salford. I remember I could see this guy coming. It wasn't that one, it was another, it was somewhere else. But I could see this guy coming. I thought, get to the end. I'm not going to tell Tom, but get to the end. And then he said, can you leave, please? But we got it in the back. It was Liverpool. Yeah. So there is that.
So when you say, Tom, that it's a slog, what aspect of it is that it's a slog? Is it is it getting one out every week?
It's the regularity of it.
Trying to find the freshness each time?
I've decided this week that I'm not going to do one for this week, which, because it's Christmas Eve, and I'm going to put out last year's sort of homelessness one. You kind of go, look, it's still relevant. It'll be the first week since this all started that I've not done one. So that's, what, 150, 60, you know. And it just seems, like I say, it's 3.5 minutes of a man swearing about Brexit. And you go, no, it's 2 days of work. And it's constant. And I feel ungrateful for it. But what I have to understand, until there's the next stage of my career, whether it's Pye or not, comes upon me, that Jonathan Pye doesn't really... All Jonathan Pye really is a Facebook page which a 3.5-minute thing is uploaded to that you can watch for free every week. That's all it is, you know. So that is the machine. That is what it is. But it is tough.
And particularly on tour, actually, when we were on tour last year.
I think that's when Angie really came on board as much more of the whole thing being a collaboration, is because we were on the road together. So we were sat in a van, so we may as well write the weeklies together. And actually, the other thing with that First Life tour, which we're writing the new one at the minute, and we're trying to avoid it at all costs, which is pretty impossible when you're doing political satire. But we started off that show... One, it started off in a 60-seater, it ended up the Palladium, so it was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But we started off with David Cameron and George Osborne being the villains of the piece.
Yeah.
Mm. I think we did a 3-minute section about the upcoming referendum. I wonder how that's going to go.
Well, yeah.
And Trump didn't get a mention because I think he was the he wasn't the nominee, but he'd announced his candidacy, whatever. But it was like he was a fucking joke. And then Brexit happened. Then Cameron went. Then Theresa May came in. Then Trump happened. Then dum 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 dum. So I mean, the day Brexit happened, the morning of, I opened my computer up and went through the script, and I put in red anything that wasn't relevant. And overnight, a third of the script just went bang.
Because it was written
middle of the tour. It was
start of the year, wasn't it? So
awful
pre Edinburgh. So much of it had to be redone, and then the tour, of course.
And then the American election happened literally in the middle.
Yeah, that's right.
So we were running up to it, and we were doing a little bit about Trump and a little bit about Clinton, getting ready to dump the Trump stuff so that we could extend the Clinton bit.
Yeah.
And then overnight it was like,
Well, neither of us predicted Brexit or Trump. We both assumed it wasn't going
to
happen.
So that's why that time was so stressful. This time around, we it's a bit more about a universal theme rather than austerity or the Tories or personalities.
Yes, you know. And so as a result, you've arrived at a point, I think, which a lot of topical comics arrive at, which is if you take a news event and talk about the generalities of it rather than the specifics, you can still do your joke a year from now.
Yeah, absolutely.
I get that as a stand-up. If I write a good joke about Boris Johnson, say, and then he falls out of the spotlight,
yeah,
I'm like, oh, please come back, please do well. And then he comes back and I can use it, you know?
Yeah. Oh, no, Hitler's dead. I'm a pretty good bit about that. Okay, so I do want to come back to the live tour and the structuring of it, which I think is really, it really works. Because I remember sitting down to watch it thinking, how are we going to take, and as I'm sure you sat down to write it, how are we going to take something which is the sharp end of the internet? It's immediate. Something happens, we can talk about it the day, the next day.
Yeah.
It's short form. It's an explosive release of energy.
Yeah.
How do you go, right, I've got to lose my temper for an hour. And as a director stroke, you know, collaborator, how do you go, right, we've got to make these moments happen? And as soon as you said in the live show at the beginning, when you say, or near the beginning, when you say, okay, we're going to go live 3 times tonight, I was like, oh, you clever bastard, that's how to do it.
It was wonderful feeling every night, because all I was ever asked when people were talking about the live show was like, how's it work? What is it going to be? Most people thought that I was just going to repeat, do live the videos that I'd done, blah, blah, blah. And what was so lovely is I walked on stage and we deliberately went, there's no jokes for 2-3 minutes, because he doesn't know he's funny, there's no jokes. And I just walked out there and went, hello, it's Children in Need night, we're going to go live 3 times tonight, this is how tonight is going to work, blah, blah. And you felt the whole audience go,
they've got a plan.
He knows what he's doing. It feels good. So that was absolutely wonderful.
And I should say as well, when you... because we're in this kind of Wild West thing of, like, stuff happens online.
Yeah.
Mm. We're not necessarily in control of it. You know, you can try and put your metadata in the hope that it'll get viral. You know, there's all sorts of things to it. But it's kind of like a balloon that you're grabbing onto. And when you look at someone like the Rubber Bandits, who... have you seen the Rubber Bandits?
I'm afraid.
Irish guys with masks made of carrier bags.
Right? Okay.
So you might have seen that thing. Brilliant, brilliant, sweary, really fun, really abrupt music videos.
Yeah.
I saw them live, and part of it is them dancing and singing and bouncing up and down in front of a big screen showing their videos, which you absolutely love because they're incredible videos, plus there's a live component. Yeah. But so no one knows what to expect when you go and see that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Now, there is a question, I suppose, I thought about, like, why go on tour? When you've got a thing which is all about news and immediacy and short, sharp shots, is it purely an economic decision where you go, I can sell a fuckload of tickets to this because at the moment YouTube are giving me £200 a year?
You've answered my question, yeah. I mean, one, it's artistically satisfying. Those weekly bits are 3.5 minutes and they are disposable. I doubt even my biggest fan watches. They might have a few faves that they put on, but they're disposable. They're you watch them, they're gone. So the live show is more rewarding because it is home to within an inch of its life, and actually it is an acting exercise technically to go on stage and learn and perform an hour monologue. It's hard work but gratifying. But yeah, I mean, yes, I get some money every time someone buys a ticket. And that is the only way Jonathan Pye earns me any money, you know. So without it, even if I really didn't want to do it, there's no way I'd be able to continue doing the weeklies if I didn't go on tour, you know. That's the only money I make. And it's wonderful because, you know, if the next tour goes well, then, yeah, I'll have the biggest pay packet in a year that I've ever had before. And you kind of go, I can... money has allowed me to continue doing this. Without it, I'd be back in the call centre. Without it, you know... So it's financially, it's essential, but also on an artistic level, it's so much more exciting than a 3-minute video that we're really, really proud of. I mean, the last time we were really excited about a video was that Trump one.
Yeah, yeah.
One making it, one writing it, which was ridiculous. Jesus fucking... you know, we'd drunk so much whiskey, but also filming it. Oddly enough, we filmed that in the Right Stuff studio because I'd had a meeting with these guys and, you know, they said, whenever you need a favour, and about a week later, it's like, well, we've written something really drunk. Can we come in and use an auto cue, you know?
That's why it looks so good.
It's a proper
professional studio camera where the others is not.
Me with a little fucking, you know. I can't remember what I was talking about.
What about the future of it in terms of looking at that kind of economic foundation? What about trying to make a permanent living out of it? You know, what other kind of structures could you see existing within? Or are you happy to go... that I've made a name for myself, now I'm going to try a different character.
I wouldn't try another character. I mean, when Jonathan Pye goes, I'm not going to attempt to be a viral hit again. I'm not going to attempt to... what's my new comedy character? That's not
a chef.
Yeah. He's an angry chef. Yeah. Yes, he's an angry postman. I want to be an actor. I want someone to hand me a script and go learn it. Off you go. You know, where I really want to see Pye is on the television. I want to know where he works. I want to know what his colleagues are. I want to know what his home life. But before I can do that, I need a television company to trust me and take me seriously. And that doesn't appear to be on the cards anytime soon.
What sort of things are you pitching?
Sitcom, but also short form. They love it, but I've yet to have anyone sign on the dotted line.
Because my guess would be, as a potential producer, as a hypothetical producer, mm-hmm. I'd be thinking, well, it works in 3-minute bursts online.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose
they need to come and see the live show,
and then they go, this is the life it can have.
You know,
it completely has. Not that there are really any parallels at all between Pye and Partridge, but you can imagine expanding the character, filling the inner life of the character.
I mean, I think they are comparable. Not in terms of genius or greatness, don't get me wrong, but I mean, Partridge is a big part of my life and has been for many years. You know, I talk like him sometimes. Ooh. I mean, the more we've seen of Partridge, the richer he's become.
100%.
He has aged so well, and the Partridge that is on now is better than it's ever been before, and I've loved it since moment one. So I would like to enrich his life. He's complex, he is funny, he's got a wit to him, he's actually got real heart, and he's desperate, and he loves his son, and he still loves his wife. I know all this, you don't know all this, but I know it, and he still loves his estranged wife, and that's what drives him. He's not pissed off with Theresa May, he's pissed off with his life, like we all are when we're ranting about Brexit and Tories and Trump. It's about... What is it? If he was content with his career and his job, and but he's not.
And there's so many intimations about his family life and his his frustration with his career. All of this stuff feeds through.
But also,
there is a big world out there.
Why I really want him to have other characters from a political point of view is though when it's a monologue, there are things he can't say because if he says them, he's said them. Whereas if he's with someone else, they can say it. And he can point out why they're wrong. So it's much easier to talk about this issue of offence that, you know, offence is taken, not given. Just because you're offended doesn't mean you're right. You know. I mean, that's what we really want to write about, this idea of this very censorious sort of puritanical age that we're sort of in.
I remember one of your videos was you were interviewing like a young conservative.
So,
is there room for modifying the weeklies to include interviews of other characters such that you could start to broaden it out like that so that you can edge closer to proving to a TV producer he can play with others?
Again, but I don't make any money on the weeklies and I don't have a huge amount of money, and the reason I can afford to do them every week is because I can stick a camera there and stick a mic on and do it. The minute other people become involved, it needs more people. It needs support. If I'm working with another actor, you need someone else there. You need to pay them. You need to, and I really want this opportunity to do it. But also, I think I don't deserve to be on the television. Jonathan White doesn't deserve to be on television. But I think he'd be good on television. And I think he's more balanced than he's not balanced, but I think the satire is more balanced than TV producers give him credit for. I can't help it. It sounds so sort of like I'm bigging myself up. I don't believe that the world has ever owed me a living, and I don't believe any TV company owes Jonathan Pye to put him on. But I just wish they would. You know, I wish they'd give us a punt. You know, we got really close to getting some real short form, 3-4 minute things on TV really recently. And we were that close. And it just takes one person to kind of go, not sure about that. And I get it. He, you know, broadcast is risk averse. I recently did something with the radio as well. And it was a miserable, miserable experience.
I think 2.5 years into what is, whether you like it or not, your comedy career.
Yeah. Yeah.
There'll be a lot of writers going, I fucking plugged away for 15 years before I
But I've been plugging away for 15 years as an artist, as a performer. I've learned a huge amount. I've worked with a lot of people. No, I don't buy it. Sorry, no, I don't buy it. I've worked my fucking arse off. And I believe I'm we're good at what we do.
And I've been doing this for a long time in the comedy scene.
If it was shit, the only reason not to put it on the TV is if it's shit. There are comedians out there I did a comedy night recently, and there was a guy that was on before me. And right at the end, he said, I've been a stand-up for 15 years, blah, 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 blah. And I just thought, well, why are you so fucking shit? Because if you've done it for 15 years, I've been doing it for a year, and it's been a fucking learning curve. Trust me, it's been a learning curve. But I care so much about it. I care so much about the work. How dare you walk on for 10 minutes, tell me you've been doing this for 15 years. You haven't made me laugh once. It's bad work. So, got my high horse there.
We're not naming names here.
No, of course at all.
I said Andrew getting the red pen out.
Can't remember her name. There you go.
I can't. But
do you know what I mean? No, I do. Like I said, I don't believe I deserve it all of a sudden, but I believe I've paid my dues.
But believe, just to state, I absolutely get where you're coming from. What I mean is that because the character is only a couple of years old, you might realistically assume that there is more convincing of the people who matter down the line than just 2 years worth.
Sure, 2 years worth.
Like, it's not about you and your own, you've been digging holes for 10 years, do you know what I mean?
It's to do with
every writer who finally gets something away on TV might have been trying to get that thing away for 12 years, say.
Yeah, well... Yeah, I've lost patience. So I mean, you know, I'm going to finish. No. I'm going to finish the next tour, and I'm going to see where we're at. That's why it's really important that the next tour goes really well, so that you can prove that he works for an hour or so. But you know, I don't want to be doing this for the rest of my life. I know the minute I give it up, about 2 months later, I'll go, oh, no one's recognising me on the street anymore.
Well, you know, judging by your previous experience, the minute you let go of it and give it up, and you're Alanis Morissette kind of
maybe,
way.
Maybe, you know. But I feel that I have... I haven't exhausted. I still like doing the weekly ones and everything, but I really, really would like to see how he can work outside of that, outside of social media. And to do that, someone somewhere needs to go, yeah, all right, take a punt. And that's what I'm looking for. And my point being, you know, I'm not getting on my high horse too much. My point being is that my very few experiences with commissioners for TV and for radio, especially, it doesn't matter whether you're any good or not. It's whether you tick the box. It's whether you tick that box. If the idea is that, as you suggested, that the comedians are going, hang on a minute, you've only been around for, this character's only been around for 2.5 years. Why should you get on telly? Well, that's absolutely fine, but it's just like, my brain might run out of time if he doesn't get on telly soon, you know. Sure. And being a character comedian or being an internet star or whatever it is, or even a political satirist, it's not the ultimate aim, you know.
Yes. So, well, let's wrap up then by talking about that, because what I wanted to focus on there was that you said, I want to talk about you and your relationship to the comedy world. This is the Comedian's Comedian podcast. Yep. There's a lot of comedy people listen to it. And I don't think that relationship, it strikes me when you said at the very beginning that that other comedians looking askance at you in Edinburgh, that struck me as really strange, and I can't imagine that happening. You said there's lots of kind of vitriol aimed at you, and I wonder where that comes from, and I wonder to what extent that is concrete, definitely happening, and to what extent it might be a feeling on your part that you're assuming it because you feel that you're not part of the inverted commas world.
Well, I don't want to be part of the world, or I don't have an ambition for the world. First of all, I think there are two different sets of comedians. The slightly older generation, the people who are my age and above, comedians, love it, get it, understand it, they think it's smart, and they don't mind being challenged. The people younger than me, they are fairly open with their disdain if he says something they disagree with. If, for example, Pye were to come out and say something controversial about, I don't know, quotas, and then suddenly people come out and have a pop at him just because he's saying something that isn't the norm. And therefore they think the satire's gone. I do think the younger generation have no idea what satire is. I don't think they get it. They don't get that it's here's a mug, I'm looking at it straight on. Well, let's look at it from down here and see what we can explore from it. So they think everything Pye says is to be taken as read. They think, which means as comedians, Where's that acknowledgement of irony or hyperbole?
Well,
I
wonder about that, because I haven't been attacked on that basis, so I can't speak to it from your perspective. But it does seem to me that when someone sees Pye say something, they might not think to themselves, oh, that, you know, they might not be taking it on face value. They might be making a set of assumptions about what the creator or creators of Pye see in the world. Do you know what I mean? It's like if Pye comes out and says, if a satirist says something that isn't necessarily fact,
yeah,
I think, do you not have to give the audience some kind of license to appreciate that actually what they might be complaining about isn't something that they've just taken blankly at face value? They might be going, well, actually, what's the intention of the people behind that?
Well,
and that might be the problem.
They're more than welcome to pontificate about that, but they invariably get the intention wrong when they slag it off. You literally read a lot of what... I mean, it is comedians on Facebook and whatever, literally going, this guy's shit, he's a bigot, he's this, that and the other. And you read it and you go, well, you're stupid, and you're stupid.
Isn't the ambiguity of the intention quite an interesting thing artistically?
Yeah, absolutely.
I agree with you. I think the ambiguity of the intention is quite interesting artistically. It's a very different take on it to these people who slag it off as stupid. Do you see what I mean?
Like, but they are. They are stupid. I mean, you know, but they are. You know, I'm sorry. I'm not going to write, and I'm not going to perform, and I'm not going to spend my career kowtowing to some Guardian munching twat who thinks they have all the answers. Whereas every time they write a comment, they are demonstrating their unwillingness, their blind unwillingness to listen to anyone else's argument. And from my very small experience of the comedy world, it is packed to the rafters with these people that think, I just, that think they know better and that they think they've got all the answers. And the idea of being challenged about anything, the idea of being challenged about anything that is the prescribed liberal view is suddenly abhorrent, that suddenly there are jaws on the floor because he said something that, you know, you look at Mock the Week 10 years ago, rape jokes are plenty, OK? And we've evolved and society has progressed beyond that point. But to deny that it was acceptable 10 years ago, it's demonstrably the case. But we've moved on, we've progressed. But now you've got people that will look back and go, that sort of this sort of revisionist sort of illiberal
view. Can you point to a specific thing that you have been picked up on that has particularly frustrated you that we can look at? And because it seems to me like rape jokes on Mock the Week 10 years ago, people denying that that happened. I don't know. Do people deny that happened? I don't know if that's a concrete
they're thing. Not denying it, but you know, things have progressed pretty quickly, you know, in that respect.
Maybe the Trump video is a good example. Because after that, there was a lot of vitriol from comics on my Facebook feed talking about that. And it was that thing about... this is unhelpful. You're blaming the wrong people. Actually, all Trump voters are misogynist, racist bastards. That seemed to be the line that was generally taken.
But it was this idea of this offence from the comedy world, that they were offended by someone writing some jokes from an angle that they didn't agree with. It was the offence that I found so extraordinary. And in exactly the same way as after the Brexit, I was amazed at the result of the Brexit vote. But what I was amazed by more are these people that voted differently to the result who aren't, for months, still doing it. Racists. Thick. I live in a racist country. I mean, those to me are the worst types of people, and I have encountered many of them in the comedy world. You know?
I would say that there is a limited tolerance for diversity of opinion on the comedy scene. I think that's a fair... And it's something that people deny, and I don't understand why they're denying it. It's true. I mean, I'll tell you. Look, I did a gig last week where the audience were asked, anyone vote Tory? If you ever get that question, anyone vote Tory? You will get no response at any comedy club ever. Anybody vote Leave in the referendum? You'll never get anyone. And it's not necessarily that those people didn't or are not there, but they know they can't admit it without being ridiculed. That's an interesting thing to me. I did a gig at the Backyard Club, which was deliberately advertised as a non-partisan gig. You know, let's have a variety of opinions, and in fact the acts were programmed to reflect that. And we did have a pretty good balance of Leave voters and Remain voters, Tories, Labour, etc. It was a really good balance, and it was a really interesting night as a result. But I don't think we get that generally. Surely you must agree. I mean,
absolutely. I totally agree with that. I think that there is an extremely limited scope of opinion, and there is I have definitely observed a sense of when people disagree with that, then often it's problematic. Absolutely. I think, it isn't really problematic. What it is people have their feathers ruffled.
Yeah, exactly.
In a way that I remember comedy when comedy was a diverse group of alternative people. And now I feel like elements of it are homogenised. My own theory on that, I suppose, is that now the speed of the discourse has increased, the pace of the discourse online, now whereby someone can use a word that wasn't offensive a year ago, and the delight with which people go, oh, no, that word's offensive now, where they themselves used it 6 months ago. I certainly see that happening, and I'm sure that is reflected in comedy.
But it's the death of comedy then. I mean, that is the death of comedy. The death of comedy is when it becomes about the politics of it, the identity politics of it, or this is fashionable, you can't say that. It's just so bizarre to me. It's the end of comedy. When people are policing themselves, when comedians themselves cannot understand that as Gervais always says, that the target of the joke it's about what the target of the joke is. So rather than, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the context of a joke. and irony, and it's being so this window, like you say, is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. It's the death of it.
And it's not people saying you necessarily. It's not audiences saying we're going to censor you. It's people self-censoring because they know that in order to be successful, you have to have a particular or present a particular viewpoint. I think that's a fairer way of looking at it. That's why artistically it's damaging.
You mean in the same way that in an audience full of people, some of whom voted leave, they will never admit it. In a group of comedians, some of whom think other than the prevailing line on social justice, they won't admit it.
Well, why would you when you're just going to be called a bigot? You know, why would you put yourself through that? Why would you bother?
The problem is people are self-censoring themselves, not because of their political beliefs, because they're fucking scared that their career's going to end tomorrow. It's the death of comedy. It's the death of art. It's fucking scary. It's really, really scary. So the problem is I play a character who's meant to be a bit controversial and meant to say a few things out there, but more and more I'm writing going, if this is willfully misinterpreted by some fucking loony liberal who really doesn't like me, they can fucking ruin me tomorrow. It's scary. It's really, really scary. And it's illiberal and it's Orwellian. And it's all meant from a good place because we all read The Guardian and we're told that it's all good. And it's not. It's absolutely horrific.
So that was Tom and Andrew. Thank you very much to them for coming onto the show. I am going to tell you a little bit more about some of the background of this episode in just a second. But before I do that, officially concluding the podcast, you can look forward to some excellent episodes with Julio Torres, Arabella Weir, Ola the Comedian, and Anne Edmonds, K. Trevor Wilson, and Colin Hoult, all coming soon as I variously gather the bits and bobs together and release them. So that's all for now. Thank you for listening. I'll speak to you next week, unless you'd like to hang around for a moment now. Okay, well, this was, as Armando Iannucci would have it, a can of furry worms. Basically, I've taken the unprecedented step of re-recording these blurbs, I call them, don't know what you call them, the bits where I talk directly to you, because the initial blurbs for this show, as released a few days ago, were quite confusing to some people, and I have to accept the blame for that. All of these shows are edited to some extent. On this particular occasion, Tom, Andrew and I got talking about a fairly complex issue to do with comedy and then ran out of time for the podcast. So we took the joint decision to not talk about it. So I've cut all that stuff out. And then when sometime later I came to record the blurbs, I realised too late that I was doing a blurb about a version of the show, which wasn't in fact the version of the show that was going out. So thanks to those of you who got in touch to tell me that it was confusing. It was. I hold my hands up to that. I appreciate your very polite feedback. And thank you for getting in touch. Many apologies that I was sloppy in my editing. And I now present this new edition of the episode in a slightly cleaner and clearer form. So you can go to jonathanpye.com or follow Tom at jonathanpyenews in order to find out the tour dates and where those guys are going to be in 2018. I look forward to speaking to you next week. Bye for now.